You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 17th of July 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London with me, Tom Edwards. Coming up...
If we were looking at this from the point of view of the interests of the country, one option within this negotiation would be Britain staying within a reformed European Union.
Britain's former Prime Minister Tony Blair says that the UK could stay within a reformed European bloc, but is it possible and what would it mean? We'll also be discussing whether Turkey will attempt to reintroduce capital punishment in light of last year's failed coup. And also ahead... Voters in an unofficial referendum in Venezuela panic as shots are fired by the country's troops. Can Maduro's government manage to cling on to power? And we'll find out how one of Brazil's most recognisable and popular brands became a worldwide success. All that ahead here on The Briefing with me, Tom Edwards. Let's kick off Monday's briefing with a browse of some newspapers from around the world, I suspect, where we're heading specifically... is to be revealed right now by Monocle's Henry Rees-Sheridan, who joins me here in Studio One.
Thanks for having me, Tom. I'm going to look at the world through the lens of some North American front pages, beginning with the New York Times, a story on its front cover, which I feel reflects its excellent coverage of the Gulf diplomatic crisis, blockade against Qatar by its Gulf neighbours. As you know from your experience holding editorial meetings in the morning, it can be difficult to decide how to cover a story like this, which is very important, but which goes on for a long time. Where do you put it on the news agenda? And I think that the New York Times has dealt with it very well. Basically, by exploring different facets of it over the week that it's been going on. And today it's chosen to focus on illustrating the open door policy in that country, which is one of the reasons why the blockade has been brought against it in the first place. It draws a vibrant picture in one western district of Doha near the campuses hosting branches of American universities. Taliban officials and their families can be found window shopping. Just a few miles away at a US military base, warplanes take off on missions to bomb IS in Iraq and Syria. And officials from Hamas work from a luxury villa near the British Embassy. It then goes on to talk a little bit about how this welcoming, shall we say, policy towards all comers has a historical precedent. Apparently, Qatar's self-identity as a centre for refuge dates back to the 19th century. It was a pretty lawless territory, and if you were a little bit of a cowboy in that region, you could disappear to there. You know, you hear a lot about the nuts and bolts of the demands being made in this blockade being discussed in the news. But I think that looking at the history of the country and it, as a component of its national identity, is a really interesting way to approach it.
I think it's very important to have a thorough grasp of history in any of these discussions that we're having. Sadly, many people, often the protagonists, don't seem to feel the same way. What's making headlines north of the border in Canada?
A sadder story, I'm sorry to say, Tom. So it is a report from Quebec. Now, you'll remember at the beginning of the year, there was a shooting in the mosque in the city. Six worshippers were tragically killed. And in spite of the fact that the Muslim population in that city are growing and they have a roots in the city, there was actually nowhere nearby to bury their dead. So a lot of the victims had to be repatriated. And from this event, there was an initiative to build a cemetery in a nearby town called Saint Apollinaire in Quebec. Now, I'm sorry to say that this has gone to a vote, and residents have decided that they're not going to go ahead with the building of the mosque. Obviously, they didn't have to give any reasons, but the mayor of the town think that it is a phenomenon of fear. And this isn't the tone that we have... that's been being reported as being struck by Canada. I think recently it's been lauded in many outlets as being oasis of tolerance, I think, particularly in a Western context, in an increasingly intolerant world. You know, this is obviously one isolated incident, but, you know, perhaps it's a reminder that we shouldn't make too many presumptions about particularly where the headspace of people who aren't in metropolitan centres are at when it comes to minority communities. So, yeah, sorry, you look like you want to say something.
I was just going to say, sage advice. As always, from Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan, guiding us through some North American newspapers. Let's switch our sights, though, as the clock ticks to 5 minutes past the hour, to the big business stories of the day. I'm delighted to say we're joined now by Bloomberg's Pim Fox. Good morning to you, Pim. What should we start with today?
Well, you know, there's this little thing, it's called Brexit, and you've got a deadline of 2019. Well, the talks between the United Kingdom and the European Union, those divorce talks, yes, they continue today. And, well, the European Union has already said that the first issue is citizens' rights, the Irish border, and a financial settlement. And until sufficient progress has been made on those things, forget it, we're not talking about trade. Plus, the U.S. Senate is going to delay the health care legislation as Arizona Republican Senator John McCain recuperates from surgery. So I guess the senators can go on their perhaps well-deserved recess break during the summer, come back and maybe do some more health care and pass a budget. Plus, we got news from China today. Yes, it's still growing. It was up 6.9% in the first quarter. That's the GDP result. But get this, they've banned Winnie the Pooh. So I'm not sure. 7% growth, you ban Winnie the Pooh, probably, you know, it's like some kind of, you know, reading the entrails of animals to determine what's going to happen in the future. They apparently banned Winnie the Pooh because there were stories that he looked too much like Xi Jinping. Also, you've got in real business, Nelson Peltz's Trion Fund Management. It wants some board seats on the members of the board for Procter and Gamble, so that'll be a fun battle to watch. Unilever wants to buy the food business of Reckitt Benckiser. But that's okay because Hormel also wants to buy the very same business, so that'll be a nice fight. Also, you just want to make a note that if you're looking for very fast internet service, San Marino would be the place for you because it's the first country in the world to be upgraded to a nationwide 5G network. Oh, yes, and that'll probably just allow you to watch more Star Wars movies, although Disney does want you to go to the theme park because they are building a Star Wars hotel, so maybe you can take your Winnie the Pooh character, check in, and eat some Chinese food.
It sounds good to me. Pim, thanks for joining us from a galaxy far, far away on today's briefing. And Pim kicked off there by talking about Brexit. Of course, it is front and centre, this issue, well, certainly here in London, almost every day. The UK's Brexit Secretary, David Davis, well, he's in Brussels for a second round of formal talks on Brexit. What should we be expecting? I'm joined on the line now by the journalist and broadcaster and friend of the programme, Robin Lustig. Robin, good afternoon to you. Well, there's the question. What should we be expecting that David Davis is going to be able to achieve today, if anything?
Short answer, not a lot. I mean, these talks are a long haul. I don't expect anything terribly significant to come out of this week. It is something, at least, that they are now getting down to the nitty-gritty. It's been a long time, hasn't it? It's over a year now since the referendum, which told the world that the voters of the UK didn't want to be members of the EU anymore. And it is only now that they are beginning to talk about the enormous complexity of how to unravel the UK's membership of the European Union. It's going to be a very long haul.
Well, Robin, on exactly that point, and I think this is something you and I have touched on briefly before, we heard at the top of the programme a short clip from former Prime Minister Tony Blair, of course, talking about that intractable set of challenges. He once again raised the spectre of this idea that it's just too complicated and we may end up just staying in some reformed way or another. I don't know. What do you make of that? Is that a degree of wishful thinking? Or are we going to arrive at a point where, because of exactly the complexity you've described, that starts to present itself as the path of least resistance?
Well, I mean, it is wishful thinking by people like Tony Blair and the 48% of British voters who didn't vote to leave the EU. It was nearly half, but it wasn't more than half. And that's the thing about votes. Those who get the most votes have their way. Look, there is a ticking clock. Britain told the European Union in March that it wants to leave. The way the rules work is that there is a two-year period during which negotiations can take place to extricate a member who wants to leave. If nothing is agreed in 2 years from March of this year, Britain will leave with no deal. Now, that is a sort of Damocles hanging over the UK. Mrs. May, the Prime Minister, is on record as having said, no deal is better than a bad deal. And my sense is that there are quite a lot of people in the EU who are saying, OK, if that's the way you want it, that's the way you can have it. So it's going to be very difficult. There is one way in which I think it is just conceivable that Brexit could be undone. And that is if a head of steam builds up behind this idea that there should be a second referendum towards the end of the two-year period, when the British voters are asked, what do you think of the deal that is on offer? Do you think the government should accept it, or do you not? If they vote no to the deal that is on offer, then it is possible, I'm told, for Brexit to be reversed. It is possible for the UK government to say, when we triggered Article 50, we now want to de-trigger it. But I think it's quite unlikely.
Indeed. What about a bit of maybe wild speculation, Robin, I'm not going to let that stand in the way, about the discussions as they progress? We've got David Davis, we have Monsieur Barnier, and it's been interesting whether you listen to someone like Boris Johnson saying, well, look, we're not going to pay an extortionate bill, Brussels can go whistle, I think he said. Yeah. Lots of tough talk from both sides. Are we looking, though, at sets of negotiators who are really willing to call one another's bluff on these big questions?
Do you know what really struck me just over the weekend, reading all the papers about supposed cabinet splits about all of this? There was a quote from an unnamed civil servant saying, never mind Britain negotiating with the EU about this, the British cabinet hasn't finished negotiating with itself. The cabinet is split. There are differing views within the cabinet at very senior levels. Chancellor of the Exchequer Philip Hammond is widely reported to want a much softer Brexit, to use the jargon, and a longer transition period than people like Liam Fox or David Davis. This means that the British government is in a very weak negotiating position because it can't get its act together. So there are real problems. The first thing that Monsieur Barnier is going to insist on is some progress on this vexed problem of how much money the UK is going to pay to the EU after it leaves, assuming that one day it does leave. The so-called divorce bill, it's going to be billions and billions of euros, and that is going to be a tough one, and that's just Article 1, as it were, on the list of negotiating topics.
Robin, just briefly, you mentioned there Hammond under pressure, and you know he's in charge, nominally at least, of the purse strings. We know how much infighting there is within the Tory administration and how much broad political pressure they're under, given the sort of malfunction at the general election. Are we going to see heads roll? Some speculation in the Westminster Village, at least, that Hammond himself is in the crosshairs of some of his rivals.
Well, his rivals, yes, but not Theresa May. I mean, it is difficult to conceive of a worse position for a negotiating government to be in. You have a Prime Minister who is weaker than she has ever been. She called an election in the expectation that she would get a great big majority. In fact, she ended up not even with any majority at all. So she is in no position at all to start firing ministers. We're told that at this week's cabinet meeting, she's going to wag her finger and tell ministers they should stop briefing the press about what goes on in cabinet meetings. Well, she can go whistle, frankly, about that. You've got cabinet ministers who are already jostling for position to take over from her. She's very weak. She can't impose her own authority. So no, I don't think any ministers are going to get fired, but I think you're going to get more and more ministers briefing against each other. The summer is getting hot. They're going to have a long break with nothing better to do than to manoeuvre and brief and whisper behind their hands.
Who would have thought it? Politicians behaving like that, Robin. Robin Lustig, thanks for joining us. As always, here on The Briefing.
Thank you.
It's 14:14 in Istanbul, 12:14 here in London. Turkish authorities have ordered the detention of more than 100 people on suspicion of links to the attempted military coup a year ago this past weekend. Well, joining me now is Monocle's features editor, Chris Lord. Chris, formerly, of course, our bureau chief in Istanbul. Chris, we spoke actually at the end of last week. You were recalling the events of that night, that turbulent weekend. What did you make, before we get into the detail of these detentions, what did you make of the weekend that we've seen in Turkey?
So last week, Tommy, as you're right, we did talk about 1 year on from the failed coup of July 15th, 2016. And one of the things we did talk about was the sense of drama that was coming with that a year on. Everything from these grand biblical looking billboards that have been put up around town depicting events from the night of the coup. And, you know, in many ways, the government of Turkey didn't disappoint in its sense of drama once the thing actually happened. And if you look, thousands and thousands of people took to the Bosphorus Bridge, now renamed, of course, the July 15th Martyrs Bridge, across the city of Istanbul over the Bosphorus. And they came to see President Recep Tayyip Erdogan come out and really, beat his chest in the name of his own government. He vowed to cut the heads off coup plotters. There was lots of violent imagery. He turned his ire onto foreign governments, including the German government, called the G20 summit a shambles or something to that effect. It was an extremely dramatic exercise in the government pushing its ideology down everybody's throats. And in many ways, as you mentioned, people have been detained again. Even more people have been accused of being associated with the coup. It shows you that sort of hysterical tenor that the thing has taken. And this events of the weekend just give them even more mandate by buying into that hysteria and giving them the right to carry on and detain more people.
Chris, that's interesting what you say. And we think back to the immediate aftermath, of course. We had, 150,000 people or so who lost their jobs or were suspended from the civil service and various other public roles. More than 50,000 detained for alleged links. Where is Erdogan and his cabal finding? It's over 100 people this time. We understand businessmen, midwives, more journalists. Are they going to continue to find people? Is it part of that broader sense of keeping people on edge that, you know, you may be the next to feel the long arm of the law?
I think you've hit the nail exactly on the head, Tom, in as much as it's about creating an atmosphere of fear and fear of the government and thereby giving them more mandate to change things as they would like to see. I mean, you know, you ask how do they find these people? Where do they get it from? I mean, if you remember in the immediate aftermath of the coup when the purge began, some of those absurd stories that came out, you know, the fact that some people who happen to have car registration plates that said FG on them, as in possibly linking them to Fethullah Gulen, who they accuse of masterminding the coup. Absurd reasons like that for hauling people into prison and putting them in front of a court which cannot be trusted in a state when the judiciary has been so overwhelmed by the government's hands. I think ultimately, you know, it is about creating a sense of fear. It's about creating a sense which is very powerful in Turkey that there are still forces within that country trying to pull it down to the ground, and that only Erdogan himself can have the hand strong enough to wrestle with those forces. And I think also as well, when you have that sense of fear, remember, Turkey's in a state of emergency, so people can't come out legally without fear of being water cannoned off the streets to demonstrate against the government. When you create a sense of fear like that, you also give the government to be disproportionate, and it gives it a mandate to be disproportionate in its responses to certain things. So I think, you know, ultimately it's a bad move for Erdogan at the moment in the broader sense. I mean, yes, it may sort of play to his very hardcore followers back home, and there is a section of Turkish society that would like to see the death penalty brought back in so that these coup plotters can be charged as such. But I think what's happening at the moment, it needs to look at its global relations, which at the moment are in a very delicate position. It's took the side of Qatar in this dispute between Saudi Arabia and the Gulf and Qatar with the Gulf countries, and it needs friends, because that's going to be major. He's lashing out at Germany. He's threatening to bring the death penalty back, which would destroy its EU bid. Turkey is in a route towards isolation, and if it's not careful, his chicken's going to come home to roost.
Well, and on that point, Chris, to sort of wrap up several of those ends, we slightly provocatively asked about the return potentially of the death penalty in the country. Are we going to see real lobbying behind that idea? Just briefly, is that something we should be worried about?
I think it is something to be worried about. I don't even think it comes down to lobbying. I think it comes down to one man, Erdogan himself. Bear in mind, when the next general election comes next year, he is going to have executive powers, which means that he can push these laws through without checks and balances and without even parliamentary decisions on it. He will be able to make those rules. And if those people, those hardcore followers of his, say, this is what we want, then that's what we're going to see from Turkey.
Chris Lord, thanks for joining us here on The Briefing. Now, more than 7 million voters are believed to have taken part in an unofficial referendum in Venezuela. Let's get the latest on this with Oscar Guardiola Rivera, reader in international law and international affairs at Birkbeck College and a regular voice of authority and reason on Monocle 24. Oscar, bring us up to speed. What exactly has happened this past weekend and where does it leave Venezuela now?
Well, we had 6,387,854 Venezuelans voting or participating in a consultation. This wasn't an official referendum and it had no observers, but the result is that close to 98% of those who voted would have rejected the call for a constitutional assembly made by the Maduro government earlier on.
And what exactly is at the heart of the discussion here? Because we saw some violence. Obviously, there's a great sense of friction. There's a lot of unease across the country, and we've been charting the problems for some time. What was really at stake, and has this really moved that on, do you think?
Well, there's a sense of trepidation, and both supporters and critics of the Maduro government agree that the country may be slipping into, very closely, dangerously closely to a civil war, and that must be preempted and avoided by all means. Now, what this particular election means is that the opposition still has a long way to go, a lot of work to do before they can mount a credible democratic challenge to the Maduro government. Listeners would be interested to know that these over 6 million votes are still lower than the 7.5 million votes obtained by Maduro when he was elected president back in 2013. Back then, over 15 million voters took part in that election, and last 2015, over 14 million voters took part in the National Assembly elections that were won mostly by the opposition. If that is the case, then the turnout for this election is very low, close to 32%. And if the result is much lower than what Maduro got back in 2013, it means the opposition still has a lot of work to do, as I say.
And what about what is at the heart of the opposition, this specific opposition, which is this sort of constituent assembly changes to the National Assembly, amendments, of course, to the Constitution? Does this mean it's easier then, I guess, for Maduro and his supporters to move that sort of agenda forward?
It isn't easy. I mean, Maduro is still deeply unpopular. His popularity, edges in between 20 to 24%, depending on which poll you look at. But if you compare that with, might mean quite low for European or American standards, but if you compare it with the 17% that Peña Nieto has in Mexico, or the 14% that his neighbor, Juan Manuel Santos, has in Colombia, or much worse, the 7% that the golpista Michel Temer enjoys, pun intended, in Brazil, then you see that he's not in a terribly complicated position. Having said that, he is unpopular. There are issues concerning the rule of law which need to be negotiated between the opposition and the government. In fact, last week, Pope Francis made yet another call for that kind of negotiation to take place. But the problem is that the opposition seems hell-bent on not waiting until Maduro's term is done, and they try to circumvent one another. Maduro's call for a constitutional assembly is one way, you might say, actually a very intelligent way of trying to get his way, trying to gain the upper hand vis-a-vis the opposition. And the opposition came back with this referendum. Now, mainstream media are touting the result of this consultation, it wasn't a referendum, as a great success for the opposition. But if you look at the figures, as I just did, that may be over-exaggerating their case.
Indeed, and Maduro himself described it as meaningless, which I guess one would expect him to say. What about on this point that, you know, he insists that the economic challenges, the political challenges facing the country are such and of such scale that the sort of reforms that he's mooted here are the only way forwards. I mean, is there any credence to that, or is it merely about strengthening his own hand and ensuring that he sort of maintains his grip?
Well, as anybody who's in power, he wants to strengthen his hand. But, you know, if you look at what he's saying, but also his gestures. Last week, for instance, he released one of the main leaders of the opposition from jail. He's now under house arrest. I'm speaking of Leopoldo López. If you look at those gestures, what you see is a message of or an attempt at reconciliation. What is absolutely clear is that the only way is a negotiated way between the opposition and the government. As I pointed out before, the problem here is that neither of the two sides, particularly the opposition, are seem to be prepared for those negotiations. So what Maduro seems to be looking forward to is the Constitutional Assembly being that the space for that negotiation. But that, as we now know, the opposition keeps rejecting that possibility.
Indeed. We'll have to keep a weather eye. Oscar, good to speak with you. As always, that's our friend Oscar Guardiola Rivera joining us here on The Briefing. Twenty-six minutes past midday here in London. And finally on today's programme, Brazil's flip-flops. Not political ones, actual ones. They are one of the country's most recognisable and popular brands. The company that owns Havaianas was sold last week. But how did such a relatively simple design become so popular, both at home and abroad? Well, I'm joined in the studio by another pair of Brazil's finest exports. No footwear. Monocles Geilerts and Fernando Augusto Pacheco are here. Faye, I'll start with you. It's interesting, obviously, when a brand like this, which is kind of, well, literally and metaphorically a flag-carrying brand in a way, is sold away. What was the view back home? Do people feel a sense of pride? Is it a success story? Is it qualified?
I think people feel immense pride by this brand. And it's funny because even I have an Havaianas shop 2 minutes from my house. So you can see the success of it. And it's interesting, and I think Gaia might agree with me, because the brand started in 1962. And at the beginning of the life of the brand, used to be like for kind of working man, you know, it used to be like something that you needed, you know, to go and work. But in the 90s, it became quite trendy. So you can be fashionable, or you can also be the guy who's working the construction work as well. So it became like a product for everyone.
Is it appropriate footwear if you're working construction, Gaia? Surely not.
In Brazil, yes.
In Brazil, yes. It's appropriate footwear in Rio all the time. Seriously, I think I wear Havaianas 90% of the time I'm back home. Like, they're very high-end places that you wouldn't be allowed, but everywhere it's practically acceptable. And also, it's interesting how Fernando was saying it's so fundamental to Brazilian life that in the 1980s it was included in sort of the fundamental... sort of one of the fundamental things for Brazilian way of life, like rice and beans, and it was a measure of inflation. So when the Havaiana prices went up or down, we would check how inflation was doing in Brazil.
And what about the sort of soft power impact? Because you've been responsible for this yourself. You have attempted to get my own son to wear Havaianas, so starting him early as a Brazilophone. But it's interesting, isn't it, how readily the country got to grips with the idea that this was quite a soft power weapon to wield internationally.
Yeah, it definitely is. I'm kind of proud when I go, you know, to Selfridges and I see a pair by something extortioning amount of, like, you know, I don't know, 40 pounds when they're actually like, you know, 6 pounds back home. But I'm actually quite proud to see them selling so well. And, you know, you see celebrities wearing them. And it's such a, as you said, it's such a simple design. But I think it comes to the fact that it's durable and it doesn't smell. I think that's a big sort of plus, because, you know, like European summer shoes are espadrilles and they smell and they don't last long and they're not comfortable.
And talking about smell, Brazilians care about smell a lot. That's why on average Brazilians take 3 showers a day. So I think that's an extremely important thing.
It is.
And it shows something about the Brazilian personality, you know, the colorful personality, the simplicity. I think that's what Brazil aims to be politically, we're managing with the flip-flops, Tom.
Just in a few seconds then, Fernando, does this change anything, the fact that the company behind Havanas has been sold, or we can set fair to continue? The story goes on.
I'm glad it's being sold, because the company that used to belong before, it's kind of involved in quite a few corruption scandals at the moment. So I think a lot of Havanas users are actually quite happy, saying, yes, we're now in a Brazilian group, which is not damaged yet by any corruption
scandal. We don't have to boycott it yet.
Fantastic.
Not yet. Anyway. Thanks, guys. That's Guy Lutz and Fernando Augusto Pacheco tracking the extraordinary success story of Havaianas for us here on The Briefing. And that's all we have time for on the programme, which was produced by Rhys James, researched by Gaia and Hester Underhill, and studio managed by Wei Dong Lin. We're back at the same time tomorrow, noon in London. Do please join us then. But from me, Tom Edwards, and all the Monday team, thank you very much for listening.